All right, if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Genesis, chapter 9. We'll get to that in just a second. So, real quick recap on where we are. We started this series on the book of Genesis back at the beginning of January. We're going to carry this through pretty much through the end of the year. And so there's a couple of, just sort of like to let everybody know where we are now. So the whole thing begins in Genesis 1 with the establishment of shalom, everything in its right place. The whole thing is as it was meant to be. There is goodness. There is an intrinsic state of this is right. This is good. This is life-giving in the first two chapters of Genesis. Then in the third chapter of Genesis, there are choices that are made and there becomes this sort of disruption to the shalom. Things are no longer as they were meant to be. And the first symptom of this disruption is there is some sort of divide between human beings. There is some where there once was connection and intimacy and wholeness, now there is shame and distance. So that's chapter 3. Then in chapter 4, which we talked about last week, there are these instances of violence. There's an escalating state of violence. So it begins with one man killing his brother, and then as the chapter goes on, by the time you get to the end of chapter 4, you have a guy killing some other guy and then writing a song about how much fun it was and how cool he is that he got to kill this one guy, and he'll totally kill again if he feels like it. So violence has entered into the conversation, but it's not just entered into the conversation, it's become fully normalized. So then last week we started looking at the story of Noah and the ark and the flood. And we looked at sort of like the whole, like the kind of the inauguration of this whole massive event was the realization that things are like that the violence has escalated to an unsustainable level. And so there is, and we talked about all sort of like the tension of what that story kind of leaves us with and why kind of rightly so we struggle with like, what do we do with a story like that? So that story ends with so you have this guy named Noah who's been told by God to build a boat and save animals and so because there's going to be a giant flood that wipes out most of humanity as the story is told. So then all that happens and the whole thing ends, and then we're going to pick up where it ends because it gets weird after that part of the story. So in Genesis beginning in chapter 9 beginning in verse 8, it says this. It says, then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now, and this is after the flood has receded. This is after everybody is safe. They're on dry ground. It says, I now, God speaking, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and a rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth. Which sounds a little bit repetitive if you read it all together like that. And it sounds like the story has wrapped itself up. And this would be a great place, if you were going to make a movie about this would be a great place to just like fade out and roll the credits. Everybody's safe. Everybody's happy. We're getting a new beginning. All things are great. Here's the thing though. The writer of Genesis doesn't stop talking about Noah until a minute from now. So it's almost like the whole thing has had this very, very nice, like wrap it up with a bow type of ending. And instead of being like, that's great, let's just leave it there, the writer keeps going and is like, hold on though, just in case you were feeling too precious about this family, just in case you had too warm of a feeling about this guy and his sons, let me just tell you one more story before we exit this part of the narrative. So then, again, this is where it gets confusing and weird. So then in verse 18, it says, the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. So then it says, these were the three sons of Noah. From them came the people who were scattered over the whole earth. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. Which, by the way, there's all sorts of like recurring imagery. This isn't necessarily important to like the overall theme of what we're talking about, but it's cool to kind of notice. One of the things we learn about Noah here, so you have sort of like this reset button kind of story, and just as the story begins to be started over again, what do we learn about Noah? He's a man of the soil. In Genesis 2, what do we learn about the first human? Is that the word Adam literally means soil. So already you have like this recurring sort of, like the whole thing is meant to sort of roll over and have a new beginning. It's sort of the idea here. So then it says, And Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. I think we can all imagine what the word uncovered inside of his tent means. So Noah gets blackout drunk and he passes out naked in his tent. Fine, cool. I mean, he's had a year, and so it's fully understandable that he's gonna need to like blow off some steam. But here's the thing. It says he planted a vineyard. You know how long it takes to plant a vineyard and get wine out of this? I get aggravated if my Uber Eats takes 10 minutes too long. This guy's like, I guess I'm gonna have to plant a vineyard because I could really use something to drink. So it takes a little bit, obviously. And so this happens. So the first thing Noah decides to do after he survives this massive, like, life-altering, traumatic ordeal is, like, I'm gonna plant a vineyard and I'm gonna, like, get good and toasted. So that's Noah's entire plan. That's the whole idea here. But which, by the way, I grew up in a Baptist church, and I don't know how many of you had this happen. This story really messes with Noah if you grew up in a Baptist church, because Baptist churches are like, no drinking ever, period, no matter what. In a Baptist church, all drinking is basically, like, drinking alcohol is like the stand-in, like, cardinal sin that covers everything else. Like, if you're hearing a pastor at a Baptist church preach a sermon and he mentions drinking, what he's trying to do is he's trying to tell you how, like, deeply troubled he is about something. And that's, like, his go-to illustration. Like, well, if you find someone drinking, who knows what that could lead to, right? I don't know. So anyway, if you grew up in a Baptist church with Noah as like this biblical hero, and this is the last story you hear about Noah, that's a bummer. And so also, by the way, because if you're having a conversation with a good Baptist, and as we all tend to do from time to time, one of the things that you might ask that person is, because they have such strong feelings about alcohol, you might ask the question like, okay, but when Jesus attends a wedding, he takes some water and he turns it into wine. You know what a Baptist says to that? The Baptist is like, oh, yeah, but wine back then wasn't as fermented as it used to be. It's basically just grape juice. Listen, that's a Southern Baptist lie. Because if it's basically just grape juice, why is Noah blackout drunk naked in his tent? How much grape juice do you need to drink for this to happen? It's not just grape juice. Stop telling people that. It's terrible. So anyway, I grew up in a Baptist church, and all consumption of alcohol was so always considered like bad deviant behavior. And so you read the story, and if you grew up like I did, you kind of lay your own sort of moral lenses on top of this, and you assume that what is being said here is that Noah has somehow like lost his favor with God or something like that. That's not really what's going on. In fact, the text never really condemns Noah drinking or anybody drinking, really. That's not a thing that exists in the Bible. There are a couple of passages that deal with, actually, the Bible's a little bit, it kind of waffles a little bit on how it talks about drinking. Take a look at the book of Proverbs, chapter 23. Because again, we tend to look at this story and assume like, oh, Noah's messed up now. Like Noah is, he's traumatized and he's making like horrible choices because obviously drinking is something you're not supposed to do. Again, if you grew up in a context like mine. So then in Proverbs 23, you have, and by the way, Proverbs is this massive book of ancient Hebrew wisdom literature. And wisdom was considered like one of the great virtues in the Hebrew mindset. So for a Hebrew wisdom poet to begin talking about things that make someone wise or foolish, what they're talking about there is something that is like at the deepest heart of what it means to be virtuous. So then in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 19, in this wisdom literature, it says, "Listen, my son, and be wise, and set your heart on the right path. Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat. For drunkards and," which by the way, I heard the wine part a bunch growing up. No one ever mentions the gorge themselves on too much meat. People would be like, wine is bad. Look at this. Also pass the brisket. There was no, you know what I mean? Like we were very selective in which parts of this we took seriously. So it says, "Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor, and drowsiness clothes them in rags." So in Proverbs, there's this language about how like drinking can be problematic for people. And so again, if you grow up in a certain kind of context, they lock onto that and they say like, see, it's a slippery slope and you shouldn't be drinking at all and drinking is bad, blah. So, but then take a look at, I added the blah, I don't know why. So then then if you go over to the book of Psalms, which is a book of Hebrew poetry, and you see this, all of a sudden, it doesn't quite look so like black and white binary, like this is good, this behavior is good, and this behavior is bad. In Psalm 104, beginning in verse 14, it says, "He, God, makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for people to cultivate." I lost my place. "And bringing forth food from the earth, wine that gladdens human hearts, oil to make faces shine, and bread that sustains hearts. So here, this poet isn't saying that wine is bad at all. In fact, this poet equates wine with oil and bread. Oil is a thing that is used often for sustaining or rejuvenating. Bread is like this sort of symbolic language of sustenance and life-giving, like what you put into your body to give you life. So here, the psalmist, the poet, puts wine next to the things that kind of keep people alive and are part of celebrations. So it's as if the writer is saying, how else are we supposed to express our joy and gratitude if we don't have wine? So in one place, you have like some warnings about drunkenness, but here in another place, the poet is like, oh, but how else are we supposed to celebrate if not with wine? So the Bible has this really interesting relationship with drinking and alcohol. So all that to say, when you see a story about Noah, and the thing you learn about him is he planted a vineyard and got drunk, if your first move mentally is to say, well, this is a sign that something bad is happening because Noah did this thing and it's obviously wrong. Yeah, no, like that's the scripture doesn't actually hold that moral position. There's sort of like this in-between space where it's almost like, yeah, you sort of have to like examine this for yourself. In fact, take a look at the book of Amos. In the book of Amos, Amos is this interesting, if you want to read just a really angry book, Amos is a good place to go. So Amos does this, it's a book of prophecy, and what Amos is trying to do is Amos is making a statement to this group of people, to this nation, and he's saying, listen, my problem with you is that you have abused the poor and that you have exploited people who have less than you. And so Amos has this entire disposition that's about justice and basically saying, you have allowed your system to create these power structures. And inside these power structures, the people on the bottom are getting absolutely trampled and destroyed by the people on the top. And Amos is saying, this cannot be sustained. So Amos then begins to talk about how at some point, you will be invaded, you will be conquered, and you will then have to face what life looks like on the outside. You will be taken to another place. He's describing the Babylonian exile. And he says, you'll be taken to another place, and you then will find out really what it feels like to have somebody else's boot on your neck, and you're not going to like it very much. And so a lot of what Amos has to say is sort of this cautionary warning of, if you're not careful, you will find you will soon discover what it really feels like to be on the bottom of a power structure. But then, towards the end of the book of Amos, he says, but it won't always be that way. And he begins to talk about how a couple of generations later, your children and your grandchildren will be allowed to return here. And they will be allowed to rebuild their homes and restructure their identity, and they will get to start again. And then, towards the end of Amos's book, in chapter 9, beginning of verse 13, this is how he ends it. He says, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills, and I will bring my people Israel back from exile. They will rebuild ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. So he tells this giant kind of sweeping epic story about how you will learn what it's like to struggle and to suffer. And you will find yourself feeling on the outside and powerless and helpless. You will find yourself in another place where you don't want to be. But then one day, you or your descendants will be allowed to come back and to rebuild and to rediscover your identity. And how does he describe what that's going to look like? He says, and when that happens, as an act of joy and gratitude and celebration, you will plant vineyards and you will drink wine. So these people, he's describing, have been forcibly carried from their home. They've been forced to live in exile. And when they finally return home, what will they do? They'll plant vineyards and they'll drink wine. When Noah steps on dry ground again and God says, you are safe, you have been made new, what does Noah do? He plants vineyards and he drinks new wine. So there is this recurring motif. So wine in the Hebrew scripture becomes sort of this symbolic element of this is how we celebrate our gratitude. This is how we express that we were in a bad place and now something new has taken place. We have been redeemed, restored, rescued. Shalom has been reintroduced into the story. And so as an act of celebration and joy, we plant vineyards and we drink new wine. The people who read Amos would have known the Noah story and they would have made this connection of, oh, this is what it looks like when we start all over again. So all that to say, the idea of Noah like planting a vineyard and drinking, that's not the problem here. The conflict is not in the, that was a long way around the block for me to be like, the problem here is not that Noah has like taken up a drinking habit or like planted the first vineyard and had what will apparently become the first hangover. So Because he does. He wakes up super grumpy. So, spoiler alert. So when Noah steps on dry ground again, there is this, again, like, oh, we're going to plant new vineyards and drink new wine. So it turns out Noah's problem, or the problem in the story, is not the drinking. The problem is what happens next. So in Genesis, go back to Genesis 9. So in Genesis 9, right after we learn that Noah is, he lays uncovered inside of his tent, in verse 22 it says, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. Okay, so this is problematic, and here's why. In the ancient Near East, in the ancient Hebrew culture, there was sort of this notion of, if you see someone naked, that person has not been brought to shame. You have been brought to shame. The idea is, if I see someone else's nakedness, I have seen something that I was not meant to see, is the idea. It's that I have seen them exposed in a way that they were not, that they had not consensually agreed to be seen. And so in the ancient mindset, if I see someone's nakedness, that doesn't bring shame upon that person, it brings shame upon me. It's up to me to avert my gaze or to try and restore the dignity of the situation. So because, again, it has a lot to do with like sort of like the honor system of like shame versus honor, and the idea of like I can bring shame upon myself if I seek out the nakedness of another. Like that's sort of kind of the implied kind of undercurrent of the story. So at this point, Ham goes into his father's tent and he sees his father uncovered. And now he has two choices. Choice one is, I can cover up my father, I can avert my gaze, I can keep my own dignity, but also I can try and preserve my father's dignity as best I can. So there's that route. Or his second choice, which is what he does, he leaves his father's tent and he goes and tells literally everybody he knows, Dad's naked in his tent. So in the ancient, as I'm sure we all would. So in... It's hard. Sometimes it's hard to like put yourself in, like, what in the world? How do you relate to a story like this? So instead of feeling the weight of that shame that Ham probably should have felt, or attempting to reduce the shame by covering his father or averting his eyes, he expands the shame, or he attempts to expand the shame and bring other people into it and to say, look what I found. So then in verse 23, it says, I'm not going to get anywhere if my Bible's upside down. It says, but Shem and Japheth took a garment and lay it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backwards and covered their father's naked body. Their faces were turned the other way so they would not see their father naked. So the two brothers have probably what would have been described as the more honorable approach to this, which is, we don't want to see that. And by the way, Ham, you shouldn't want to see that either. Like, this is none of your business. He's inside his tent. You know what I mean? And so you have gone into a space and seen something you shouldn't see, and your first impulse is to go and invite other people to see a thing that they shouldn't see either. And so the two brothers' response is, we are going to try and restore some amount of dignity in the situation. The brothers honor the humanity of their father and of themselves by choosing not to look at his nakedness and cover him up. So the story now raises lots of questions about how we see and respect other people. So again, like it's hard, I think, sometimes to look at these stories and say, like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, how do you, again, like we talked about last week, I don't remember VeggieTales dealing with this part. So what do you do? What do you do with a story like this? How do you find any sort of way to connect it to reality? Well, imagine living in a world where a famous actress's phone can be hacked and naked photos of her can be shared by millions and millions of people that she's never met. You know what I mean? Like, imagine finding something that was never meant to be seen by the public and becoming one of the many people who shares that thing with other people. What is that? That is us attempting to not only see something that is none of our business, it is an attempt to expand the number of people who are seeing something that is none of our business. So imagine a world where you could be standing in the checkout line at the grocery store and see a magazine featuring a story about how a married couple from another country has decided to create some distance from the husband's very powerful and wealthy family. You know what I mean? Imagine having really, really strong opinions about what a prince in the UK is going to do with his inheritance, or where he and his wife and child are going to live. Imagine having really strong opinions about that when you've never met that person and you never will, and it has no bearing on your life whatsoever. Imagine. Or imagine seeing a headline, like a clickbait, as you scroll, that says, guess which celebrities haven't lost their baby weight yet? You know? like, why is that a thing anybody needs to be thinking about or to know about? What is this? How is any of this different from what Ham does to Noah? How is my impulse to share gossip and slander about somebody, or to share maybe just something that's embarrassing to somebody with other people? What is that? Oh, that's a very old, very old impulse to say, instead of turning around and trying to cover up, or at the very least saying, maybe this isn't for me, instead saying like, oh, I wonder if anybody else has seen this too. You know what I mean? So perhaps the question here isn't, should Ham have told his brothers about their father's nakedness? Maybe the question is, do I have a habit of telling other people about the nakedness of other people? The story, I would argue, the story challenges the moral dignity of the share button. And this story calls into question, like, in what ways do I attempt to point people towards the shame of others? You ever, if you grew up in a youth group, you ever do prayer requests? And you ever say, like, okay, there's a thing that I know, and I probably shouldn't know it. And if I just tell everybody about it, people are going to think I'm gossiping. So here's what I'm going to do. I just want to offer a prayer request. You know, this girl in my class, I don't want to say her name, but it's Julie. She's pregnant. And you know what I mean? Like oh, cool prayer request. So, like, you know what I mean? Like, there are all sorts of ways that we sort of enter into our own lives and sort of live out this story in these really dark ways. We expose and we present to other people things that are really not for us to either share or consume. And so this is a story, at its core, this is a story about what do you do when you encounter the shame of somebody else? And what do you do when you encounter something that was not meant for you? And do I attempt to preserve the dignity of the other, or do I attempt to expand the shame of the other? That's sort of the core issue inside of this story. Do I use my words to honor the humanity of others, or do I use my words and actions to bring shame and harm to others? So that's one dimension of this story. The second dimension is this. If we keep going, take a look at verse 24. In verse 24, it says, when Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, and this is where the hangover kicks in, he said, cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. Which, by the way, if you've been paying attention, Canaan is not the name of the son who saw him naked. Canaan is the name of the son who caught him naked. So now he's just like throwing curses out at his grandson, which seems unnecessary. And then it says, he also said, praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be the slave of Japheth. This says, after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Noah lived a total of 950 years, and then he died. That's the end of the story. The whole story ends not with, like, there's a rainbow, there's a new covenant, everybody's fine now. It ends with Noah getting naked and drunk, waking up super angry, cursing his grandson, and then that's the point at which the writer's like, I think that's enough. I think we can end here. What? If this was a movie, you'd hate it. And the reason I know that is because they made a movie about this starring Russell Crowe several years ago, and people hated it. Because they, and I mean, not the least, like one of the reasons, not the least of which being like, they included this part. I thought the movie was pretty good, but lots of people really didn't like it. And I think one of the reasons they didn't like it is because it kind of tore down sort of the notion of Noah as like this, like, higher, bigger, larger than life biblical hero. And it's like, yeah, but sometimes Noah, and by the way, if you look through the entire like Noah narrative, Genesis 6 through 9, this is the only dialogue he has. He never says a word during the entire like ark flood story, but when he wakes up drunk and curses his grandson, he's got all kinds of things to say. So this is the only language, this is the only verbiage that Noah ever gets, and it's like the worst possible thing he can do. This is how it ends. So the main issue in this passage is there's a curse now. So Noah wakes up, he's angry, and he curses not only his son, he curses his grandson and the descendants of his grandson. This is very harsh language. And a lot of this is, again, it's about like shame. Like Ham has brought shame upon himself, and he's brought shame upon future generations. That's the idea. That's sort of what the writer's getting at. But at its core, this is a curse that's being spoken. And the curse is expected to be carried on for future generations. Now, at this point, I feel like I have to offer a bit of an aside, because this passage has been used in the name of doing very, like, just truly terrible things throughout history. Because what people have done is they've taken this and they've tried to sort of work out, like, oh, well, which which people groups are the true descendants of Ham? Because according to Genesis 9, that these people groups are inferior to other people groups. And so people have taken these passages and in a just truly evil, toxic kind of way, have decided, well, this group of people is probably the descendants of Ham, and so we can abuse them, we can try and wipe them out. Like, attempts at genocide have happened with this passage in somebody's back pocket, for sure. Or, if you want to make it more recent, in the history of the American South, pre-Civil War, this passage was used to justify slavery. So, like, white supremacy has been held up in part by this passage. So, in fact, if you were to go into a church in the mid-1800s in, say, Alabama or Mississippi or Texas, and if you heard a white preacher using this passage, what that white preacher would be doing is he'd be trying to create some sort of justification for the institution of slavery. This passage has been used to do unspeakable amounts of evil. So, I feel like I have to acknowledge that right out of the gate, because to not mention that felt wrong. It felt disingenuous. But also, it kind of points back to this tendency we have to look at certain things in the Bible and to say, well, this is what it says is supposed to happen. And so this is what it's supposed to be. Like, we talked about this back when we looked at Genesis 3, and we talked about how, like, the curse of, like, the man, quote, ruling over the woman, or, like, exploiting his relationship with the woman. And so we have these languages of these curses, and what we've had is we've had people who, in bad faith, I would argue, have entered into their own cultural context and used these passages to uphold, basically, the words of a curse. But if we look through the whole scriptures, one of the things that we find is the goal here is not to live inside of a world that is dominated by curses. That curses are not meant to be embraced. A curse is a lament. A curse is, maybe this is the worst possible version of the story. They're meant to be overcome. One of the dominant themes in the entire body of the scriptures, from Noah's rainbow to Jesus' empty tomb, is the undoing of curses. Our work in this world is never to say, well, the curses says this, so I guess I'll have to go with this. The work in this world is, okay, what are the curses? Where did those curses show up, and how can we push back against them? Our goal in this world is shalom. Our goal is to participate in the reordering of things in the name of something that is good and loving and holy and gracious and peaceful. So when we encounter a curse, our job is not to say, well, this is what it's supposed to be like. Our job is to say, what can we do to unravel that particular curse? What can we do to push back on that particular kind of narrative? So a curse, again, is a lament. It's an expression of how things are not supposed to be. So the task of humanity is to see where the curses have been spoken and to push back against them. So also, by the way, does this pattern look familiar? There's a new creation. There is the consumption of a fruit. There is nakedness and shame. And then there is the breaking of a family relationship. Are you with me? Like the flood story has been over for like a minute, and all of a sudden the pattern has restarted. The pattern of distance and pain and shame and violence is already beginning again. So again, this is sort of part of like, well, what is it that we're supposed to do with this? It's our job to recognize where these patterns occur. It's our job to recognize where the curses are and push back against them. How do we find these dark pathways and to say maybe there's a better way? The point of a curse is not to live inside of the curse. The point of a curse is to recognize, oh, these are the darker patterns, and it's our job to find something better. And sometimes the dark pattern begins with exposing the shame of somebody else. And rather than trying to minimize shame and pain, attempting to expand it. So maybe one of the things that we're invited to do is to preserve and honor the dignity of other people. And this is, by the way, this is different than if you see someone like abusing power and using it to hurt other people, like exposing that is good. That's justice. What we're talking about here is not justice. What we're talking about here is what happens when we have access to something that we are not meant to have access to. When we have access to someone's privacy. When we have access to something that is meant to be intimate and closed, and we decide to just open it up to whoever wants to see it. These are two different things. So please don't think I'm talking about, like, if there's a situation of justice, like, no, that's a good thing. Those things need to be exposed. But what we're talking about here isn't that. We're talking about what does it look like for us to try and protect the dignity of others and to try and minimize the amount of shame that people feel in their own lives. It's our job to recognize the patterns and to bring and to push against them in some sort of way. So when we seek out the metaphorical nakedness of other people, or when we find entertainment in the vulnerability of somebody else, that person is no longer a human being in our eyes. What that person has become is a statistic, a cautionary tale, a punchline sometimes. A lot of times when we should be asking, like, what can we do to preserve this person's dignity? Instead, we point a spotlight at it and expose more of it for a couple of reasons. One of which is that it takes the focus off of us, but another is sometimes it's just entertaining. Sometimes we just wanna be in on the story. And so one of the things I think the story invites us to do is ask questions about what does it look like for me to preserve and honor the humanity and the dignity of somebody else? Because when I find someone uncovered in their tent and my first impulse is to share it with everybody, I don't see that person as a flawed, vulnerable human being. I see that person as a story I can tell. And so when I do that, it doesn't just bring shame with me into the tent. It diminishes my own humanity. It diminishes the humanity of everybody that I invite into it. And so our goal here is not to expand and live inside of the curse. Our goal here is to push back against the curse. So where do you see the curses? Where do you see people sort of living in a place of shame? Maybe you feel exposed. Maybe you feel a certain amount of shame. Maybe you feel like somebody has seen something and you there's a little bit of embarrassment, and there's a little bit of, like, every time I leave my house, this is what people are thinking when they see me. Maybe this is an invitation to kind of let yourself off the hook on that a little bit. Maybe this is an invitation to simply say, maybe there's a better, more gracious, loving way I can be thinking towards myself. So what does it look like for me to honor the dignity of others, to honor the dignity of my own humanity? What does it look like for me to push back against the curses and to bring something that is more gracious and loving and peaceful into this world? We're going to take communion with us, and everybody is welcome to take communion. The bread and the cup are fully open to anybody who wants to take it. If you don't want to, that's totally okay as well. But may you find that your impulse is to preserve the humanity of other people, and may you find that you are in the business of pushing back against curses and in the business of bringing something good and peaceful and loving into this world instead of darkness and pain. May we find that we are not just restarting the same patterns over and over and over again. May we find a better way of living. Let me pray for us. Sorry, almost as if I was praying. God, we thank you for the invitation to preserve and honor the humanity of others. And we, for those of us who feel shame, for those of us who feel exposed, for those of us who feel quite vulnerable, may we find peace in the midst of that kind of chaos. May we find that we are in the business of protecting the vulnerability of others. And may we find that we are in the business of pushing back against the curses. May we find that we are invited to participate in a story that is about renewing and restoring life and not in tearing it down. And as we receive the body broken and the blood poured out, may we be reminded that this is the kind of story that we're invited to participate in. May we choose a path of grace and generosity and peace and love, and not a path of shame and violence. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.